Ave.
And welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University. This is episode LXXXVI, Ascent to Greatness, However Steep and Dangerous. I'm paraphrasing historian Edward Gibbon here. Septimius Severus, now ruler of Rome without opposition, had been all things and always of little value. He is now distracted with the care, not with acquiring, but of preserving an empire. Here's Kaelin Davenport. After Septimius Severus has dealt with the problems within his own empire, he immediately needs to turn and give his attention back to the Parthians. Mm. They've attacked Rome really during his campaign against Clodius Albinus. So what's the situation here? Are they being opportunistic? And why is this still a problem after Marcus Aurelius fought a war against the Parthians?
Yeah, I think they're definitely taking advantage of the fact that Septimius Severus has been occupied in the west. I mean, certainly Septimius's first Parthian war against the vassals would not have gone unnoticed. And you very often find that Parthia and Rome are always fighting over intermediate kingdoms. You might remember with Lucius Verus, the kingdom of Armenia was certainly a bit of a battleground between the two places. Here it is Mesopotamia, and the Parthians under Vologeses invade the Roman territory there, and they lay siege to Nisibis, which doesn't fall because of the success of Julius Laetus, Septimius Severus' general, who proved so successful and saved his bacon at the Battle of Lugdunum. But this is a situation which now demands Septimius Severus's presence in person. Certainly from the period of Marcus Aurelius onwards, we find this necessity for emperors to take their campaigns to the front in person. That's now what emperors are supposed to do.
The last time there was a Parthian war, Lucius Verus was in theory doing the same thing, but he hung well back from the front lines, didn't he?
Yeah, no, Septimius Severus is not like Lucius Verus. He's not going to sit in Antioch and enjoy the pantomimes and the prostitutes, etc. like that. No, he's going to make his name. I mean, certainly after both civil wars and a sort of minor first Parthian war, this is a way to really put an imprint on Roman Eastern foreign policy. Mm. As part of this, he actually creates three new legions: the first, second, and third Parthican legions. Two of these are going to be stationed in Mesopotamia in the east, whereas the Legio II Parthica is going to be stationed at Alba, so only 14 miles south of Rome. Now, this is a really important innovation. This is really the first time in hundreds of years in which a legion has been stationed very close to Rome itself.
Does that kind of indicate that he doesn't trust Rome to behave while he's gone?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. These legions are under the command not of senators, but of equestrian prefects. They have a different command structure. This doesn't mean Septimius Severus distrusted senators. As I've mentioned several times, Septimius Severus had loyal senatorial supporters. But what seems to be apparent about these new legions is that they and their commanders answer to the Praetorian Prefect, who is now Septimius Severus's own relative, Gaius Fulvius Plautianus, and he's going to be a very powerful figure. Mm. So leaving one of these in Rome and two in the east is going to help to secure both those fronts.
It's an interesting step to take, because usually the legions are seen as a way to control. So if they're based in an area, you know that place is going to be well controlled. For it to happen in Rome.
Oh, it's definitely the case. And if you go up to, you can take the train up to Albanum today and you can see the city is based, well, it's not really a city, a town, is based on the grid of the legionary camp. It's amazing. And you can see Rome from there. This is as a clear message: I'm coming back, I'm going away. I mean, he leaves trusted supporters as urban prefect and other key roles while he's off in the east with Plautianus himself and also detachments from these new legions. Septimius Severus takes on the Parthian king Vologeses. He's actually accompanied by Vologeses' brother, So not all Parthians are necessarily opposed. He does have an ally. And many of these cities are abandoned, particularly Seleucia and Babylon. And then he finally captures the Parthian capital of Ctesiphon. Vologeses has fled, but Septimius Severus and his troops unleash on the city. Cassius Dio says in book 76, 9.4, later upon capturing Ctesiphon, he permitted the soldiers to plunder the entire city, and he slew a vast number of people, besides taking as many as 100,000 captives. That's probably inflated, but, you know, this is sending a clear message. He doesn't want to annex Parthia. That's the thing. He just wants to send a message, you know, if you invade our territory, then we're going to invade yours.
Consider the message heard, but not uncharacteristic, I think, of what happens when the Romans take over a city. There's invariably plunder, slaves, and a bit of murder.
Certainly. You know, that was, you know, a way of letting the soldiers, you know, work off steam after a campaign. You know, they're not going to turn against their commander. So this is at the end of 197 that Ctesiphon falls. On January 28th, 198, he is proclaimed the conqueror of Parthia. So Trajan was Parthicus. You might remember that Lucius Verus was Parthicus Maximus, as was Marcus Aurelius, the greatest conqueror of the Parthians. But then Marcus Aurelius gave that up after Lucius Verus passed away. But Septimius Severus now is Parthicus Maximus again. And he takes this title on 28th of January 198, you know, 100 years since Trajan's accession.
To the day.
Yes, to the day, yes. You know, it's a master propaganda there. And it also means that the Roman army and Roman people, there's a calendar of festivals to which, you know, they make libations and sacrifices to every year. They celebrate the dates of imperial accessions, their birthdays and other important events. This is ensuring that Septimius Severus is now going to be forever linked in celebrations with Trajan. It's not just part of this moment, it's going to recur every year throughout his reign and throughout Roman history afterwards. So it's a wonderful ploy. It's really quite wonderful.
But he doesn't just link himself to Trajan, he links his son's position and status as well.
Exactly. So Septimius Bassianus, who has been renamed Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, now aged 9, and is given the title of Augustus. He and Septimius Severus are both now co-emperors of the Roman Empire, just like Marcus Aurelius and Septimius Severus were.
I find that amazing because when Marcus Aurelius was the emperor, there was question marks over him letting Commodus ascend so quickly to adulthood and to becoming co-emperor himself.
Yeah.
And Commodus would have been around 15 at that point.
Yeah.
Now we've got somebody 20 years later, a 9-year-old being made co-emperor.
Septimius Severus is showing that he is the founder of a dynasty that will continue, and it's the continuation of the Antonine dynasty. I mean, Antoninus, the young boy, has no real power. He's a symbol of this dynastic continuity at this stage. But in all the titular throughout the empire, they now both have the title of Augustus. So, you know, putative villager off in Mauritania, you know, they're seeing they now have two emperors. There's Septimius Severus and there's Marcus Aurelius Antoninus again. This is a clear signal. I mean, you have to be sorry for poor Geta, you know, who's only 1 year younger than Antoninus and is not made Augustus. I mean, Geta is off there on campaign, but Septimius Severus always clearly favours Antoninus, later known as Caracalla, above the younger son, Geta. So in 197, Geta is made Caesar. He won't be Augustus until 209, about a decade later there. But there is a problem. So Septimius Severus, now the greatest conqueror of Parthia, but he also wants to take Hatra, which is a city to the north, just south of Mesopotamia, the Roman province of Mesopotamia there. So he wants to take that and make sure that it's going to be loyal to Rome in the future.
So this is the first major challenge that this campaign has had by the sounds of it, that it is unable to defeat the city of Hatra.
Yeah, I mean, Trajan had also failed to take Hatra. Despite all the siege engines, they couldn't take the city. And the troops there began to grow restless. One of the Praetorian tribunes, Julius Crispus, quoted some verses of Virgil bewailing their conflict and was executed. Also executed was Septimius Severus's general, Julius Laetus, who was wildly popular. Indeed, Dio says the soldiers used to declare they would not go on a campaign unless Laetus led them. And that's Dio 76:10.3.
So he was executed for being popular.
Exactly.
And another man was executed for quoting Virgil.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Strong literary criticism. So is Septimius Severus just, is he losing his cool at this point? Is this what the indication is?
I think he's getting frustrated. The fact that he can't take Hatra and that he doesn't want to be any possibilities of one of his senatorial generals replacing him. And certainly the popularity of Laetus and the fact he played that crucial role at the Battle of Lugdunum suggests that he is a man that perhaps would encourage the soldiers to turn against Septimius Severus. And so, according to Cassius Dio, he then launched another siege of Hatra, but once again that failed and they had to come to terms.
Right, so at this point does he declare the Parthian War over with and leave it to its own devices?
Yes, essentially he moves on. He does reorganize the frontiers in the next year. So, you know, making sure that Mesopotamia is now a fully fledged Roman province under the command of an equestrian prefect. Septimius Severus calls it a bulwark for Syria. Cassius Dio is not convinced and says this has been a costly expedition, which really hasn't secured the frontiers at all. And Septimius Severus now travels to Egypt. This is really a key province for any Roman emperor because it is the
food bowl.
Yeah, it's the grain supply. That's what you need to keep control of. And with Pescennius Niger recently having taken control of the east, it's good for the emperor to go there. And certainly he does a bit of sightseeing while he's there as well. He goes and sacrifices to the spirit of Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, Pompey the Great, Caesar's rival, who was killed rather unceremoniously when he stepped off the boat in Egypt, you may remember. And he was killed by someone called Lucius Septimius. So this is a nice bit of historical parallelism, I think.
No relation, though.
No, but it's something that Septimius Severus would probably have picked up on. He also, you know, goes on a bit of a Nile cruise. He also went to pay his respects to another famous general. And this, of course, is Alexander the Great, whose tomb was in Alexandria. Cassius Dio says he locked up the tomb of Alexander. This was in order that no one in future should either view Alexander's body or read what was written in the above-mentioned books. Septimius Severus takes away all the sacred books of the Egyptians that no one could use them. Septimius Severus was famously superstitious, you know. I mean, it was an offence to cast the emperor's horoscope or something like that. You know, you were accused of having designs on the throne by trying to find out when the emperor was going to die. But Septimius Severus had, you know, his star sign painted on the roof of his bedroom and things like that. So he was particularly into secret lore there.
Wow.
And this is Cassius Dio 76:13.1-2. But certainly visiting the tomb of Alexander, I think, is important. I mean, Augustus had done that, infamously broke off Alexander's nose accidentally. But also, you know, Septimius Severus has waged an Eastern campaign, so he's trying to link himself to Alexander. But also there's the idea that Pescennius Niger claimed to be, you know, a new Alexander as well. So he's completely putting paid to that idea as well there.
Yeah, okay. So it seems a bit strange, though, that he would do this, make this journey, and in some ways be paying so little attention to Rome.
Well, he needs to be an emperor for the empire. We saw this with Hadrian, for example. You know, his two larger provincial tours. You know, emperors have to pay attention to the elites of the provinces. And one thing that happens under Septimius Severus is that he allows Egyptians to enter the Senate for the first time.
Yeah, right.
So before that, you know, there was a Senate at Alexandria, but they couldn't become members of the Senate at Rome. So in a way, he's winning favour from this province in particular.
While Septimius Severus is enjoying his Nile cruise, he's not alone, of course. He's got his entourage and his family, but he's also got with him somebody that you've mentioned a couple of times, Plautianus.
Yes, so this is Gaius Fulvius Plautianus, who's of equestrian rank, but has now risen to become sole Praetorian Prefect. So he's commander of the Praetorian Guard. It's the most powerful equestrian position in the Empire. And in a way, well, he's effectively Septimius Severus's right-hand man. He even does away with other prefects in order that he can be sole prefect.
Is this a situation that is dangerous for Septimius Severus to have somebody of this power? Because he doesn't get along with Septimius Severus's family to start with.
It's dangerous to put all your trust in someone who's going to get other people offside. You might think back to Tiberius and Sejanus. Mm. And indeed, Plautianus is very often compared to Sejanus, but perhaps even more extreme. So Septimius Severus really relies on Plautianus, and Plautianus is given, you know, extravagant titles. He's even included in inscriptions for the Domus Divina, the imperial household, the divine household. He's given the title of a relative of the emperor. He's called Comes, official companion, on all Septimius Severus's expeditions. So he's always there as the right-hand man. And yet he is such a controlling character. He's very hostile to Julia Domna, Septimius Severus's wife, and abuses her verbally frequently. He's known to have statues all around the empire that are said to outnumber even those of Septimius Severus. Indeed, his power is so much that someone is said to have written to Plautianus as if he was a fourth Caesar. So they just got confused and thought that he was actually an emperor as well.
Oh, wow.
And he's able to be the gatekeeper to the emperor and also wield patronage and control access to officers the same way that someone like Cleander was able to under Commodus. Cassius, though, has some great stories. At home, he castrated 100 Roman citizens of noble birth, though none of us knew it until after he was dead. From this, anyone may comprehend the full extent of both his lawlessness and of his power. Nor was it boys or youths alone he castrated, but grown men as well, some of whom had wives. His purpose was that Plautilla, his daughter, should have only eunuchs as her attendants. And that's Cassius Dio 76.14.
How likely is that? That seems to be quite a large scale for it to go unnoticed. Is that Cassius Dio painting him in a bad light once he's died?
Certainly, Plautianus does fall from grace. He's accused later on of conspiring against Septimius Severus. So yes, I mean, he doesn't come off very well in the ancient sources. On the other hand, I think the rather interesting comment is that though none of us knew of it until after he was dead, either something really did come out or, you know, it's a rumour that sort of started about all his extravagance. Perhaps, you know, there were 5 eunuchs and in the telling it grows and you suddenly have 100 eunuchs or something like that.
So yes. Ironically, like Hitler only has one testicle.
Yes, it's quite similar to that. Plautianus is enormously powerful. Even Septimius Severus grows jealous. I mean, when he hears about all the statues Plautianus has, he asks for some to be melted down. And when the messages get sent out, people think that Plautianus has died and fallen from favour, because you only knock down statues of Praetorian prefects when there's damnatio memoriae, essentially.
So Septimius Severus is in this awkward position where he needs to try and keep his friend happy, essentially, his trusted advisor, and his family happy. And it seems that neither parties are getting along well with each other.
No, not at all. I mean, Plautianus is extremely ambitious, both for himself and his daughter, Plautilla, is one way to achieve this. After his trip through Egypt, Septimius Severus and the retinue return to Syria. And the beginning of 202, Septimius Severus and his eldest son and Augustus, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, hold the consulship as ordinary consuls. They give the name to the year. They actually hold their consul inauguration in Antioch.
So neither of the consuls are in Rome?
No, neither of the consuls are in Rome.
Wow, okay.
So this is presaging something we're going to find in the later empire when consul inaugurations are being held outside. This is really good for the provinces. They're able to experience imperial power.
Sure.
And they get a lot out of being close to the emperor. By April, the imperial team Severus, are back in Rome when they celebrate Septimius Severus's Decennalia.
Right, so it's been 5 years since Septimius Severus has been in Rome at this point.
Yep.
And 10 years of being emperor.
Exactly. So the Decennalia is your 10th anniversary festival.
And he spent less than 6 months, I suppose, in Rome all up.
Yes, yeah. He's sort of come back and forth there in between campaigns, but now he's back and he really needs to make a statement, particularly since last time he's there, there were quite a lot of senatorial executions.
Mm.
Now it's going to be celebration. He gives 10 pieces of gold per head to the people of Rome, a massive donation to the Roman citizenry. And you get all these wonderful gold coins minted, you know, proclaiming things like the happiness of the times, the happiness of the century, featuring Septimius Severus and his family. So Julia Domna, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, and Geta on one side, and then Septimius Severus on the other hand. So, you know, the dynasty proclaimed security for Rome. And it's now about to get larger. Antoninus is married to Fulvia Plautilla, who is the daughter of Plautianus.
So can I ask, Plautianus can't come from a prestigious background, really, with, you know, a strong lineage of consuls and senators. So what's the benefit of marrying your eldest son and successor to the daughter of somebody from that background?
Well, Plautianus is a relative of Septimius Severus, so someone also from Leptis Magna. He's of equestrian rank, but his power far outstrips his actual rank. And he's actually made a senator and consul, and he's made a patrician as well. So he's elevated into the top ranks of senators while still being a Praetorian prefect.
Is this so his daughter is important enough to marry the son of
I think it all goes together. Yeah. It all goes together that it's recognizing Plautianus's power, but it also means that there's some sort of equality between Caracalla and Plautilla. But it's really a sign of Plautianus's power. Marcus Aurelius Antoninus and Plautilla do not get on. They hate each other. There are no children born. There's coins that are minted, you know, expecting the hope of children, you know, to continue this dynasty, but none emerge. And, you know, there's fantastical celebrations. Cassius Dio, book 77.1, says, Plautianus gave as much for his daughter's dowry as would have sufficed for 50 women of royal rank. We saw the gifts, so Cassius Dio, the eyewitness again, we saw the gifts as they were being carried through the forum to the palace. We were all entertained together at a banquet, partly in royal and partly in barbaric style, receiving not only all the customary cooked viands, but also uncooked meat and sundry animals still alive. Presumably, I think in the Loeb translation, they note it's probably seafood.
Oysters.
Oysters, yes, exactly, rather than, you know...
ostriches.
Ostriches, yes, being served out alive there. So this is a great celebration, both of dynasty, but also of success. You know, you only have celebrations if everything is going well for the Roman world. This is certainly the message which is articulated by a major monument which is now erected in the Roman Forum, the Arch of Septimius Severus, to celebrate his success in the Parthian campaigns. And the arch is dedicated to Septimius Severus, his son Antoninus, and originally Geta as well, but his name was later erased. And it's dedicated by the Senate and the people of Rome to these emperors on account of the restoration of the state and the extension of the empire of the Roman people by their outstanding virtues, both at home and abroad. So the imagery of the arch all refers to the Parthian campaign, the Second Parthian War. But the Latin inscription, which I've just referred to, refers both to the civil wars.
And the restoration.
The restoration of the state. So, ob rem publicam restitutam. So, the state has been restored whole under Septimius Severus, and they've even extended the empire of the Roman people in the east there as well. So, he can legitimately celebrate this foreign victory rather than just being an emperor who was successful in civil wars.
Mm.
In 203, Septimius Severus and the imperial family went on a field trip to a brief visit to Leptis Magna, Septimius Severus's hometown, and there magnificent arches were built in celebration of the imperial family, and they depict Septimius Severus, Antoninus Geta, Julia Domna, and even Plautianus in triumph. So this was a way of paying tribute to his hometown. But it was only a short visit in the first half of 203, then he returns to Rome.
But it was during that visit you get all the building work started, I suppose, that really make it the ruins that it is today.
Yes, I mean, they embellish the route from the harbour to the Forum, for example, and a lot of the iconography in the form of Leptis Magna features some of Septimius Severus's favourite deities, like Hercules and Bacchus, that also appear on his coinage there. And there's an arch, you know, which pays tribute to his Parthian campaigns there as well.
After Septimius Severus goes home, visits his family, has a reunion, builds an arch, he comes back to Rome. In 204, it's time for the city to have a really quite big and infrequent celebration.
Yes, this is the Cicular Games. They're held to celebrate the completion of the Cyculum, a period of 110 years. The idea is you would only have this opportunity to see this once in a lifetime. The last Cicular Games were celebrated under Domitian in AD 88. There are festivals. It's a religious celebration. All the priests, senatorial and equestrian, marshal. There's a hymn sung by the young boys of the senatorial order. Back in Augustus' time, it was Horace who wrote the Carmen Saeculare, the hymn for the Cicular Games.
Can I just say that this is the last time that it'll be held?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, because the next time Zosimus complains that it isn't held by the emperors. Coins are minted with the legend Ludi Saeculares to commemorate them. And Cassius Dio is a bit confused in that in his narrative he conflates the Decennalia celebrations with the Cicular Games. But we know from an inscription which records the Ludo Saeculares that the event he describes, which I'll talk about in a moment, takes place in 204, not 202. So 77.1.3, Cassius Dio says, "At these spectacles, 60 wild boars of Plautianus fought together at a signal, and among many wild beasts that were slain were an elephant and a coracotta. This last animal is an Indian species and was then introduced into Rome for the first time, as far as I'm aware. It is the colour of a lioness and tiger combined, and the general appearance of those animals, as also of a dog and fox, curiously blended. The entire receptacle in the amphitheatre had been constructed so as to resemble a boat in shape, and was capable of receiving or discharging 400 beasts at once. And then, as it suddenly fell apart, there came rushing forth bears, lionesses, panthers, lions, ostriches, wild asses, bisons. This is a kind of cattle, foreign in species and appearance. So that 700 beasts in all, both wild and domesticated, at one and the same time were seen running about and were slaughtered. For, to correspond with the duration of the festival, which lasted 7 days, the number of the animals was also 7 times 100.
That sounds like an event that Commodus would approve of.
I think Commodus would have loved to have been there. But Cassius Dio's description here of this event is confirmed by coins, which actually show the ship with animals bursting out of them. So coins were minted to commemorate this sort of once-in-a-lifetime event, which wouldn't have been seen otherwise. So I think in 204 we can see that, you know, Septimius Severus was riding high. You know, he had no more rivals, he had a successful campaign, he had two sons, a powerful and trustworthy prefect. Antoninus was married to Plautilla and expected to produce children to carry on the dynasty. So what could possibly go wrong?
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it through Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Reviews are appreciated. We like reviews. It helps us feel the love. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, a small Christmas break, Feliz Navidad, and we'll have a closer look at the Arch of Septimius Severus. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.